The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
We just heard people screaming.
I've seen his videos over social media. I've got many friends who know him personally. And hearing the news, I was shattered and devastated and wanted to come here and offer my prayers and any help I could. And the night just unfortunately got out of hand.
It's the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, well, good afternoon and welcome. I don't know if you recognize the accent. Of course, it's from our brothers and sisters down under, people reacting to a horrific event. I heard about this the other day. A bishop stabbed. Have you heard about all these attacks on clergy? And again, I just, you know, I see mental illness play a role in some of this, but I see the demonic clearly. Satan hates what priests do in confessionals. They hate the truth that they speak. They hate the sacraments that they bring. There are several stories about attacks on clergy. In Amarillo, Texas, there is a priest by the name of Father Tony Noosh. He was hearing confessions. I don't know if you heard about this. This is terrible. He was there at the Cathedral of St. Mary's when a supposed penitent, somebody came in to confess her sins, who was dealing, of course, with some mental health issues, pepper sprayed the priest in the confessional. They pepper sprayed him. I often think about these priests. I think, you know, imagine if some madman came in there, right? Somebody who is clearly delusional or maybe even possessed. And what if they decided to take a knife and stab you to death or shoot you? Right? It's absolutely horrible. Go ahead, Maggie, open your mic. I don't remember that. Maggie was saying that happened.
Yeah, there was a priest like last year, I think, that was stabbed in the confessional, or he was just coming out of the confessional.
Wow. Horrible. You know, and these men sit in there. They hear some of the darkest confessions, and, you know, they are willing to, in some respects, lay down their life. This priest, Father Noosh, who's the cathedral rector, he wrote on Facebook, he's fine. The confession schedule, of course, has been suspended. Confessions now are only by appointment until they can get security cameras installed in the area. I guess that's for people coming in the church and going, not in the confessional. But the opening audio you heard, in Sydney, there was an Assyrian Orthodox bishop who was attacked by a 15-year-old. This teenager had a knife and started attacking him during the bishop's homily. And the live stream of the service was interrupted after the attack, and people who are watching quickly gathered outside the church, you know, of course, to protest. Go ahead, Maggie. Yeah, please open your mic.
I watched this video, and someone was kind of analyzing it and breaking it down as well. The teenager attacked him during their liturgy, and the bishop held up a simple wooden cross.
I didn't know that.
His instinct was not to turn away. He just held up a wooden cross as this young man was coming towards him. Oh. And apparently the switchblade did not open.
Oh.
And so it looks like he's being, you know, like,
yeah, I thought that he was attacking his face and his neck.
Right. It looks like he's being stabbed, but you can actually tell he's just being pounded. The switchblade did not open. And maybe it did at some point, but the first couple blows, the switchblade did not open on him.
I bet this bishop's an exorcist. I mean, clearly, I love it. You know, God is he's far more powerful than evil, right? Or we see supernatural protection. I talk about it all the time. That switchblade didn't open. I didn't know that. That's clearly the prayer. Did he back down? No, he held up the crucified Lord. I love that story.
Isn't that beautiful?
I also think about what happened like in Hiroshima. We talk about it all the time. Ground zero, nuclear bomb, atomic bomb goes off, and you walk away unscathed, never a day of cancer in your life. Power of prayer. They were praying the rosary. I mean, we see the fruit of prayer. We see God's protection. So don't give in to fear. Don't give in to anxiety. Satan loves when you are afraid. Yeah, love when you are afraid. There was one other story I saw. And I only bring this forward to you because I've been, you know, there's been some church vandalism and stuff. I'm not going to report on that today. But The Guardian had reported that police had to keep this suspect inside the church for his own safety. Two other people were wounded, supposing the attack. And in Myanmar, formerly Burma, two masked gunmen walked into a Catholic church and they shot at a priest, Father Paul Shane Ung. And he was reportedly struck in the jaw, hand, and thigh, but he survived that attack. So, hate to lead with that, But God bless our priests. I love them. I do. I think they demand our prayers. They need our prayers. You know, my wife this morning and I, we were talking about Father Simon. And she says, you know, people often think priests don't need prayers, right? Unless they're sick. But priests need your prayers. I'm telling you, Satan has a special enmity. He has a hatred for these men because they free you and me from the chains of sin. They administer those sacraments. They are there for us in persona Christi so many different ways. And I invite you, pray every day for your priests. You know, if you pray a rosary, if you pray a chaplet, if you spend time with the Lord, just say, just call them out by name, the priest you know, or those priests who maybe are struggling with their vocation. Father Rocky was sharing with me a story. I think members of Opus Dei do this. And what they do every day is all the members of Opus Dei, all those who are in that work, they pray one memorare for the person who most needs it that day within Opus Dei. And what a beautiful thing to do in your own family, right? How about one Hail Mary or one memorare for the person within your family who needs it most? That's a lot of prayer coming from everybody for that person, right? I bet you a lot of people don't get any prayer. Be a great habit to start, or maybe do it for your priest. How about starting that in your own congregation, your own church, parish? Have we talked about praying for priests? I'm just brainstorming here with you, all right? Here's an idea that just came to me. In your church bulletin, why don't you go and say, hey, do the same thing. Get all the members of your parish to offer one memorare a day for your parish priests or for the assistant priest or whoever's in the parish. You know, wouldn't that be great? Not everybody's going to do it every day, but I guarantee you that priest will be covered by prayer. And believe me, he needs it. So anyway, we're continuing to pray for Father Simon. EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, announced a new rule program. And I've been praying for our country. I don't understand, and I'm going to talk about this probably in greater detail tomorrow. How can we as a nation get pro-life legislation, right? How can we move forward and return this country to the nation God intends it to be when a majority of people in this country want death and they want abortion? So the EEOC imposed pro-abortion measures now on the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act. And that act gives certain protections to working pregnant women. And under the direction of the Biden administration, they're going to publish a 400-page set of rules on Friday, and it mentions abortion on nearly every single page. Can somebody tell me, maybe explain it to me. Maybe I'm missing something. I mean, you can call me and tell me. What is it about this administration that is so rapidly pro-death? You know, why is it that this has got to be pushed down the throats of every single American? 400-page set of rules is going to be announced this Friday. Nearly every page mentions abortion. Roger Severino from the Heritage Foundation talked to to Washington Watch. He said how horribly out of touch this administration is enforcing a pro-abortion agenda into what should be pro-life legislation. Listen to this.
Yeah, it's not surprising in one sense, but their creativity apparently knows no bounds when it comes to pushing abortion on the American people. As you mentioned, the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, this was a bill designed to protect pregnant workers. What is the opposite of pregnancy? Abortion. Yet this administration, through EEOC proposed regulations, is saying that abortion is going to be a protected, enshrined right, that workers will have a right to an accommodation, even in pro-life states. And they're going to use a supremacy clause argument saying that the federal law is going to push aside all the pro-life state laws that prohibit cooperation and assisting in abortion. So employers around the country are going to be forced to assist in abortions in violation of state law if the Biden administration gets its way in flipping what protection should have been for pregnant women on its head.
People get very disturbed at what I'm about to say next, but I can't in good conscience see how any citizen could vote for this administration who wants to advance this type of scar on our nation. That's what it is. This is a wound. You know, we talk about slavery. This is just as bad. I mean, I think these disillusioned people think they're on the side of right. There's something severely wrong. And Maggie, you have a theory on it.
I mean, I've heard too many exorcists speak about how abortion is the high holy sacrament of the demonic.
It is.
And this, it seems like obsession. It's obsession. It's infiltrated every possible avenue that they can to make everything about abortion. And it's just, it's sick. It's a sickness.
It's the only answer. I mean, maybe somebody else has an answer for it. Feel free to call me. It's 888-914-9149. But it's clearly demonic. It clearly is. I go back to Aztec Mexico when human sacrifice was being offered to the gods, these demonic demons, these false gods. And Our Lady came and vanquished it, right? You know, the rules, and it just shows you how sinister this is. You know, what I was reading earlier, they said the rules do not exempt religious employers from having to allow and even pay for an employee to take a day off to go get an abortion. You might have your own business. You want to pay an employee? Oh, yeah, you can take the day off. No, go have the abortion. I'm going to pay for it. No way. No way. Alliance Defending Freedom. They said this. They said the Biden administration and the EEOC don't have the legal authority to smuggle this illegitimate rule into a law that was created to protect and support women and that had nothing to do with abortion. This is evil. Maggie's right. How do you take something that has nothing to do with abortion, has everything to do with what should be life, and what do? On a 400-page set of rules, you mention abortion on nearly every single page. I'm sorry. I don't care. I don't care if you write in no name on your ballot, right? I'm not telling you to vote for Trump or RFK or anyone else. I just can't see. Like, you got to stand before God too. And when you hear something, when you understand truth, when you understand what's now being done and you want, and you go ahead with the authority of your own vote, the power of your free will to go ahead and to put into office somebody who's going to continue to advance this type of stuff, I don't know how in good conscience you can do it. That's just me personally. Okay. I know people don't always agree with that. Robert F. Kennedy, right? Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He's running as an independent, right? Well, he hasn't changed his position on abortion either. According to the National Right to Life, he is just as firmly ensconced in the Democratic Party's position on abortion, which is abortion on demand up until birth. Can I repeat that one more time? That's abortion on demand up until birth. So you got the Biden administration. You've got this candidate who some people are rallying behind right now. Pray for the heart of RFK. You know, he's not better than Democrats when it comes to this issue, even if he's running as an independent. And of course, we have our issues also with President Trump and the line that he drew. But he was asked by a pro-life voter at a town hall event held by WMUR 9 in New Hampshire. I don't think she liked his response. Listen to what he said.
I was a Democrat for many years, decades, but the Democrats do not accommodate pro-lifers. What reason can you give me to a pro-life voter to vote for you regarding this divisive issue?
Well, the only thing I can say to you on that issue is that I don't think the government has any business telling people what they can and cannot do with their body. I'm not going to be in a position, allow myself into a position where I'm going to be telling a woman to bring a child to term that she doesn't want. I don't think it's a good solution. I think every abortion is a tragedy. But I don't think the government, I think the worst solution is that the government is involved in decisions that should be belong to a woman.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of speechless on some of this stuff here. It's frustrating to me. It is really frustrating to me. I talk quite often here about the role of government in encouraging its citizenry to be virtuous, right? It's the only formula for a successful nation. You know, and our founding fathers knew that. I have quoted them ad nauseum, right? It is so key. One of the most direct roles of government. One of the most direct roles is to encourage virtue amongst not only the citizenry, but through the implementation of laws and policies. And what we're seeing from this administration is the absolute opposite of that. I mean, do you think ethical behavior is good for society or not? So this can include laws that you know, we've got laws against fraud, against corruption, right? There are all sorts of other laws against things that harm a society. And yet we see what's happening here. It's quite, quite crazy. Let me take a quick call. I got David Wormster on hold. I'm going to get to him in a quick second here, too. But let me jump down to Florida. Hey, Rick, thanks for dialing in. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Drew. Love your show.
Thanks.
And just wanted to have a comment. I read a book on the miraculous metal recently. And one of the conversions in there was from a high wizard. And I don't know if you've read the book, and I don't recall the name of it, but it was Miraculous Metal Conversion Stories. But anyway, this gentleman who was like a high wizard for like 10 years, at least 10 years, yeah. He said that abortion played a role in almost all the wizardry that he did.
Yeah.
Like they had to, he actually witnessed and was involved.
I know that, Rick, I know that wizard, believe it or not. He's been on the show.
Yeah.
And
okay.
He had his name is why am I zoning out? Zach King, Zachary King his name.
Yes, Zachary King. Yes.
And you know he had an unbelievable conversion on the spot there as a result of that. And that I'd love to know the name of that book because that's one of many great stories attributed to that medal. That medal was initially when it was given to Bernadette. Say Catherine Labouré, when it was given to her, it was known as the Medal of the Immaculate Conception, but so profound, so prolific, so many were the miracles that took place to it. It quickly got redubbed the Miraculous Medal. And you look at the fruit of it. The greatest fruit, I think, is not healing. I think it's conversion. And when you go from a guy who's involved in Satanism, blinded by that, to complete freedom and now a powerhouse for the Lord, I think that's incredible. Rick, thank you for calling in with that. I appreciate you sharing that. And like I said, when I opened the show today, God is infinitely more powerful than evil. And we need to pray, all right, and be virtuous people ourselves. We could talk much more about that, but let me change gears for just a moment. You know, I didn't talk a whole lot yesterday about the conflict between Israel and Iran. And I've been thinking about it, and I'd like your take on it, too. We're going to get, as I said, David Wormser on in a second here to get his take. I wonder how big this can get, if at all. It comes right on the eve. You know, this strike came on the eve of so many things that seem to, I don't know, have a confluence together from eclipses to the Feast of the Annunciation to so many other things that are happening. And I hope Israel shows some restraint. I think there will be some sort of retaliation, whether it's visible, whether it's attributable, I'm not sure. This conflict between Iran's proxies like Hamas and Hezbollah and Israel, especially in the Gaza Strip, have been playing out. But when we saw Iran, well, let me back up a little bit. Israel hit an Iranian consulate in Syria because intelligence officers said that the Iranian generals who planned that October 7th event, by the way, October 7th is a very significant day. It's the actual feast of the Most Holy Rosary. They come in on this very same day. It's also the day that, you know, in Lepanto, that there was a great battle against Islam and those Islamic forces were ultimately defeated. But anyway, that's a separate note. October 7th, the attack takes place by Hamas. What happens? Well, they were right. The generals were taken out. They're now dead. Iran, of course, couldn't let that go without a response. It's kind of the way they operate. It's got to be a response to it. So last week, they took over a freighter in the Red Sea that Iran said had some connection with Israel. Then Saturday, of course, they launched what we all witnessed, 300 drones and all these missiles towards Israel. And fortunately, I think 99% of them, the vast majority of them were taken out with the help of the U.S., the U.K., France, and even Jordan and Saudi Arabia. And the U.S. has asked Israel not to retaliate. Israel's not happy about that, and it will probably do whatever it has to do. But there are commentators that believe that what happened on Saturday was basically theater. And others say, that's ridiculous. It's very real. No one wants a much wider war than what's going on in Gaza right now. So the question is, how big can this get? And it seems that things are not settling in the Middle East. They're only getting They're only getting hotter. So I've invited David Wormser today to stop by, senior analyst for Middle East Affairs at the Center for Security Policy. And it's great to have him here with us this afternoon. You can check him out, centerforsecuritypolicy.org. David, thanks for your time. Good afternoon.
No, it's an honor to be with you, Drew. Great honor.
Thank you. I love your take on this. When I watched this unfold, you know, gosh, it was so bizarre watching the missiles travel. It was going to be a couple hours, and of course, they were all taken out. And there was a theory that was floated very earlier that this was theater, that Iran had a safe face, so, you know, they fired these off knowing that, you know, they would probably be taken out. Others say that's not the case at all, that Iran really wanted to hurt Israel, and it just shows how inept their missile program is right now. How do you read it? You know, what do you think was behind this? Was it a big show? Was it Kabuki theater, as one commentator said? Or does it show really the ineptness of Iran and its military strength?
Well, it shows in part the ineptness of their military strength, because half their missiles never really got off the ground. But it also shows the incredible technology and capabilities of our forces, our sailors and soldiers, airmen, because both our planes shot some of these out of the sky and our Navy shot a few missiles out. And the Israeli air defense structure, which shot about 200 of the 300 projectiles coming. So it shows that, but at the end, I think it's not a Kabuki theater. This was an attempt to hurt. They tried. They figured at least 10% would get through. 10% of that, of 200,000 tons of warheads, would be 20,000 tons of TNT landing on your head.
Wow.
Which is a lot. Yeah. So luckily, the Israelis and the United States and the UK and the other allies, by the way, Saudis and Jordanians. Stopped it, and nothing got through, and only one seven-year-old girl was injured. What Iran was after, I think, is to cause tension between the United States and Israel. That's the strategic play they're trying to do.
Yep.
They see this administration at odds with Israel, and they want to drive that wedge deeper and deeper because they know the United States is terrified of escalation, so they keep trying to push escalation.
Yeah, expand on that for me. Let's stop on that point, because it's such a critical part of what we're now seeing unfold. U.S. comes out, asks Israel not to retaliate. And some people say, well, they want peace, and, you know, there's other ways that they can retaliate. There'll be sanctions. There'll be other things that are going to be taking place. But what is it about the U.S. and Iran? Or let me pull back from that. What is it about the Biden administration and their policy towards Iran? It was very different than the Trump administration prior to that. And who knows what's going to happen in the next 4 years. Where are they, and you know, how do they view Iran, and why are they capitulating on so many different ways to them in so many different ways?
It's really an extension of the Obama administration policies, which were essentially that you can come to terms with this government in Iran, and they operate under this theory that you can essentially strategically give them enough so that they'll come to terms with you. And it's again and again disproven. Iran, ever since 1979, has been at war with the West, and it has one objective, and only one objective, which is eventually to destroy the West. I mean, they mean it when they say death to America. So I think that this administration and the Obama administration didn't get that, and they thought they could come to terms with them. And because of that, they're so afraid of their theory being disproven by some escalation. The Israelis, on the other hand, feel that they're under the direct crosshairs of a genocidal maniac government. And so they want to go after that. And I think right now where you're seeing the real fissure between the United States and Israel is the oil fields. Yep. Israelis want to go after the oil fields because that's the money for Iran. Yep. And the United States doesn't want them to go after the oil fields because the price of oil will go up and President Biden will lose the election. So you're seeing tension. That's exactly the wedge Iran is trying to drive.
What role does the United Nations play, though, in mediating this conflict? You know, the U.S. saying, hey, don't retaliate. We'll get the U.N. involved. But how do you see that playing out?
Well, the Israelis don't have a lot of credit. The U.N. doesn't have a lot of credit with the Israelis. Yeah. So it's really the United States. The United States is Israel's ally. Israel has both not only dependent on it, but it's also very pro-American. Yeah. So what America wants matters to the Israelis. That's the real leverage to restrain them to some extent.
How are we viewed in the Middle East right now? Are we stronger because of our support of Israel and what we just did militarily and our presence there? How do the nations view the United States and its presence there?
Well, Iran, we told Iran very clearly, don't, and they did.
Right, I know.
And I think that tells you how we're viewed. I think Saudi Arabia felt this administration was hostile and turned away. They tried to overthrow this government in Saudi Arabia, so the Saudis are upset. The Israelis are a bit raw. America looks weak in the region, and it isn't because of the war. The war is a consequence of looking weak. So I think this is a real warning sign for America globally.
Right. Hey, I have a moment or two left. Do you think Israel's going to retaliate militarily, or will they do something by other means that are maybe not attributable to them? Or what do you think the next page in this chapter is going to be?
I think it'll be complex. I think they will retaliate militarily. They will also retaliate clandestine over the next few months, but they will to retaliate militarily. But they've promised their Arab allies, the Arabs they've made peace with, that they're not going to do something that will throw the whole region into war.
Good.
So I think they're going to focus on a few critical areas to go after. Again, they would have preferred the oil because that strips Iran of its money. But because of the United States, they're probably not going to do that. They're probably going to go after maybe nuclear installations or things that the Saudis, the UAE, and others really are scared about as well.
Yeah, no kidding. I kind of hope they do take out those nuclear capabilities.
Yeah.
Hey, David, thank you for your time. Always good to talk to you. I appreciate your expertise.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
If people want to check you out, of course, they can go to centerforsecuritypolicy.org. And David Wormser, you can check him out, WRMSER, Senior Analyst for Middle East Affairs there, the Senator for Security Policy. I have to take a quick break. Stay with me when I return. On the other side, we'll change gears. We've got a very diverse show coming up. I don't know how you feel about this. There's a new theory out on crime. And there was a Wall Street Journal article I saw. And the author made the case that Americans are being misled, that crime is far more rampant that's even being reported. And I'd love to hear from you. If you are experiencing it, give me a call. Share with me what you're seeing and how it's all unfolding. We'll get into that. And just as a side note, a little bit later, right after the Chaplain of Divine Mercy, we're going to pray the chaplain in about 30 minutes. On the other side of that, I've got a very special guest joining me, the mother of a young man who had a bullet in his head. And through prayer, I believe a real miracle is unfolding. She will share his story. It's an amazing story. That and much more straight ahead.
Insight and analysis right here. It's the Drew Mariani Show. Relevant Radio.
So look, people have to acknowledge, particularly media, whose job it is to use the facts, acknowledge that when you're letting millions and millions of people in, 10,000 per day in some cases, they're unvetted. It doesn't mean that all of those people are going to commit violent crimes, but it does mean that some of them will, and that those crimes were preventable.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, thanks for joining me today. It is good to be here with you this afternoon, taking a look right now at, your world. And the federal government, of course, wants you to believe economy's humming along. Do you agree? How you doing? Is your wallet a little plumper today than it was a little while ago? They say it's doing great. You know that their strategies and plans are working. What real people are experiencing on a day-to-day basis are two different realities. Maybe the data says one thing, but most people I talk to kind of are having a difficult time. And I know people will say that when they leave the grocery store, they fill up their car. So the federal government and the mainstream media, they also want you to believe that crime rates are going down. And that's good news. I want to believe them, right? Even though surveys show that Americans believe that crime rates are going up, especially property and violent crime. The media keeps telling us, oh, that's not what the FBI stats say. And you know what? The media is right. They're right. The FBI, which is the country's official statistic keeper on crime, it shows that crime rates around the country are falling. They're going down in big cities like New York and Chicago, Los Angeles. You're saying that's not true. Drew, come on. That can't be the case. New York, Chicago, L.A.? Yep. How about Baltimore, Memphis? No, they're going down. But you know why? Wow, here's the thing with statistics. The FBI statistics are wrong. The media, they're not telling you, what they're not telling you really is that the FBI changed the way that they collect the data. And you can't do that and still be comparing apples to apples. And on top of that, cities where they were getting the data from, they found a new method to confuse their staff. You don't forget, police staffing levels have plunged along, across the country right now. And having personnel filling out federal forms is the last thing I think a lot of police commanders want their officers doing. And the other key point, too, is that not only have staffing numbers dropped, but citizens have become frustrated and they stop reporting crimes. They're just not reporting them. Somebody breaks in your car in the middle of the night, you don't have surveillance video. Well, good luck trying to catch whoever did that, right? So let's talk about this for a little bit. The silence. Is crime really going down? Well, the arrest rates are plummeting. So the public's willingness to step forward, I think they're seeing people get arrested or not arrested. And if they are arrested or let go, they figure, why even file, right? The chance of a criminal facing justice is slim. So why go through the ordeal of a report? And that is particularly evident in some of the largest cities where reports of violent crimes are at the lowest. Shockingly, they have low arrest rates. So delighted to have with me today John Lott. He's president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, which you could find at crimeresearch.com. He served as legal advisor for research and statistics in the offices of justice programs and the Office of Legal Policy at the Justice Department. And I'm delighted to have him with us today. John, thank you for your time. Good afternoon.
Thanks for having me on. Yeah, it's crimeresearch.org is the website.
Perfect. Yeah, I read your piece in the Wall Street Journal, and I thought, man, I never thought of it like that. When you see these cities that crime is rampant in, and yet you see the statistics, I'm thinking, well, what's the truth? And then I saw your piece, and I thought, man, that's great. So tell us about the new way the FBI is collecting data, what it means in terms of how much data we're actually seeing, and why it's being reported today that these rates are down.
Right. But you mentioned the FBI data. There's two types of data. The FBI collects what are reported crimes to police. But we know that the vast majority of crimes have never been reported to police.
Right.
And so what there's a second set of data where the Department of Justice, the Bureau of Justice Statistics, surveys about 240,000 people each year to try to get an idea of what's the total crime, reported and non-reported crime. And what's been happening over the last few years is there's been a big gap, a growing gap between those two different measures of crime. While the reported crimes have gone down, what you find is that non-reported crimes have soared during that period of time. So between 2021 and 2022, the FBI reported violent crime showed about a 2% drop. At the same time, the National Crime Victimization Survey showed a 42% increase in violent crime. And so there are three things that have been going on with the FBI data. One is we have over 30% of police departments in the country haven't been reporting crime for the last few years to the federal government. And the government goes and tries to estimate, the missing cities that are there and their issues about how they're estimating that. The second thing is that even the cities that have been reporting crime, the FBI, for some unexplained reason, has been picking a different number than what the cities have been reporting to them. And they've been consistently picking a number below what the cities have reported to the FBI.
What's your theory on that before you get to point three? What's your theory on that? Why would they do that?
I worked in the Department of Justice. I think there's a lot of politics that are going on there with the data people.
Gotcha.
I can't tell you for sure that that's the case here, but it's surely a puzzling thing that's going on, and it's something that needs to be explained.
Okay.
But I think there's a third thing, and my own belief is this may be the most important one. And as you mentioned, we've seen a drop in arrest rates that we've never seen in recorded numbers. If you look at cities over a million, as you were talking about, in the 5 years before COVID, 44% of violent crimes, reported violent crimes, result in arrest. And that's been falling from 2020 on. By 2022, that was down to 20%. So it went from 44% of violent crimes, reported violent crimes, result in arrest to 20%. And just to give people an idea here, if you look at total violent crimes, reported and non-reported, you're talking about 8% of total violent crimes result in arrest. And if you look at property crimes, you're talking about 1% of property crimes result in arrest. Now, that isn't even dealing with charging.
Wow.
So not even all arrests result in a charge, and not all charges result in a prosecution. And obviously not all prosecutions result in a conviction. And so you're, for property crimes, for example, you're talking about something we don't know exactly because the Department of Justice doesn't collect all the necessary data on this. But you're talking about something that's going to be well less than 1% of property crimes in cities with more than a million people are going to result in a conviction. And even for all cities, yep, it's still just over 3%. And so, you know, those are just shockingly low numbers. I mean, criminals have really little to worry about if they're going to be engaged in property crime, and they don't have a lot more to worry about if they're going to be engaging in violent crimes that are there. And so, as you said correctly, and this is something that researchers have known for many decades, is that as the arrest rate goes down, people are less willing to go and report crimes, and they're less willing to report it for multiple reasons. One is, as you were saying, kind of what's the point of spending the time reporting it if nothing's going to happen? And also, particularly for things like violent crimes, people are reticent to go and report it because they could go and report somebody, but if nothing's going to happen to the person, if they're not going to be arrested, that person may retaliate against the individual who reported them.
Or they'll be arrested and let out. I mean, you see these arrests and they get a slap on the wrist, and I don't blame somebody who's been traumatized by that. You know, and it's not just about these numbers either. You hit on some really important issues here. According to the stat I'd read, 22 million Americans now carry concealed handguns. 22 million. I was shocked by that number. You know, that's a testament to their fading confidence in public safety. They don't feel safe. That's why they're walking around with a concealed weapon. And the narrative is, to me, is clear. I mean, a lot of people feel they have to protect themselves because the system is failing to do so as well. Fill me in on...
Well, it's even more than that.
Yeah, go ahead.
22 million Americans have a concealed carry permit, but we now have 29 states that have adopted so-called constitutional carry laws where you don't even need a permit.
That's true.
And so we did a survey last year where about 15.6% of registered voters in the United States are carry most or all the time.
Wow.
That's up dramatically from a Pew survey that was done in 2017, which indicated that it was just over 5% of people were carrying at that time. So that's basically a threefold increase in the rate that people are carrying.
Wow.
And, you know, one can only imagine how much worse violent crime would be in some of these areas if you weren't, at least, you know, you're not making it risky for them to go and commit crimes with law enforcement. Law enforcement isn't being allowed to do its job. As you mentioned, there was cuts in police budgets, changes in rules, prosecutors refusing to prosecute violent criminals, bail reform, judges who have let out over the last few years in some urban areas, 50% or even 2/3 of the inmates from local jails. You know, if it wasn't for the fact that at least victims, in many cases, being able to go and defend themselves, making it at least risky in that way for criminals to commit crime, how much worse it would be.
No kidding. Hey, John, hold the thought. I had to take a quick pause here. When we come back, maybe we can explore what the ordinary citizen can do. If they don't have a concealed carry weapon, you know, if they are concerned about, you know, I guess being safe, you know, what do you do? Is it a matter of voting? I mean, what can the average citizen do? We'll do that. We'll take a few calls, too. If you want to join me, I only have John Lott for a few moments. The number's 888-914-9149. There's something else we didn't talk about either, and I'll dive into that when we return.
Your news. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Your news now.
The Chaplet of Divine Mercy, live, coming up. You're listening to The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, hey, thanks for joining me. If you're just tuning in, we will pray the chaplet in about 10 minutes. But right now, I ran across a recent Wall Street Journal article by a man named John Lott. And he paints a stark picture of our nation right now grappling with a hidden surge in crime. And I want to underline the word hidden. It's a story that is a lot grimmer than a lot of these media outlets report. And, you know, in this program here, I always try to give you a look at life you're not going to find anywhere else, give you some perspective and some insight that you may not get from your mainstream media. So what's going on? According to a Gallup survey, a stunning majority of Americans right now across political lines feel that crime's on the rise. I know you might feel the same way. I don't think they're wrong. The Federal Bureau of Investigations, they are showing a decrease in crime reporting. But the real experience of a lot of people is telling a very different story. And the question is, what's happening? It seems that faith in our system of justice is faltering. Arrest rates are plummeting. The public willingness to step forward is plummeting. The chance of a criminal going to jail, that's plummeting. Right. So you got to understand we're in a weird place right now in America. When I left off, I was talking to John about the fact that, minimally 22 million Americans now carry concealed handguns. But he pointed out there are numerous states where you don't need a license to carry. So what do we do as citizens? Right. And is this the byproduct, perhaps, of this whole defund the police movement that we've seen in some of these very blue liberal states? And you've seen a lot of those states, the pendulum begin to swing back when crime got so rampant. They're thinking, maybe police are a good idea. John, thank you for your writing. Good to have you back with us here. I know if people want to check you out, they can go to your website. It's crimeresearch.org, and they can see all the stats. Crimeresearch.org. You can also search the Wall Street Journal for that article. I think the headline was Americans being misled, crime more rampant than being reported. Give me your take on defunding the police. What impact did that have? And then maybe if you could follow up with us, I mean, what do we do? I mean, how do we remedy the problem in a population where voters feel powerless? How do we remedy this situation?
Right. Well, I think police are the single most important factor for reducing crime. I don't think there's any doubt about that in my academic research. And, you know, it's not just been cuts in police budgets. I mean, New York City in 2020, for example, cut its police budget by $1 billion a year. Yep. You had Chicago in 2020 alone cut the number of police officers that it had by 400 positions. And, you know, you've seen that across the country in many places. But it's been more than that. They've changed the rules under which police officers operate, which have made it much more difficult for them to go and do their jobs. And you've also had many things that demoralize police. As you mentioned earlier, prosecutors who are refusing to go and prosecute violent criminals. You know, it's not just civilians mm-hmm. who decide what's the point on going reporting crimes to police. Right. You also have police kind of wondering what's the point of arresting people if they're going to be immediately released and they're not going to face any charges for the crimes that they're committing. And so police also are affected and not going out there and arresting people as vigorously as they would have otherwise, not just because they face many more obstacles in doing it, but also because there's not much point to them doing it in many of these cases. Yeah, I mean, you have district attorneys around the country who, for example, are refusing to prosecute property crimes. And so, you know, it's not too surprising that you only see 1% of property crimes resulting in arrest in cities with more than a million people. So the question is, what should people do? Well, I mean, one thing is to go and change who are the district attorneys in these places. And because crime and law enforcement's a local issue.
It is.
Policing policies are determined locally by cities. Judges are elected locally. District attorneys are overwhelmingly elected locally. And judges determine things like whether they're going to release inmates from jails. Yep. They also determine what penalties that they're going to face. And so, one of the ironies is that you have people like Bragg and Manhattan and Kim Fox in Chicago who say that you shouldn't go and put people in jail by race. You know, you should, if blacks make up 13% of the population, they should only make up 13% of the people in jail. But here's the thing that's never talked about, and that is, who do you think they're committing crimes against?
Yeah, right, exactly.
People commit crimes against people who are like themselves. 90% of murders are committed by blacks. Murders of blacks are committed by blacks. And they commit them in their neighborhoods. You know, the stores that are put out of business, who disproportionately owns them? Who works in those stores? Yeah. Who shops in those stores? Who owns homes in those areas whose property values are depressed because of the higher crime rates that are there? It's overwhelmingly minorities, poor minorities that are being harmed.
It's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard, that, you know, you're going to only put people in jail by the color of their skin. Let's take the color of the skin out of the equation and just put people in jail who break the law. Right? Isn't justice colorblind, or at least shouldn't it be? Absolutely ridiculous. John's in Missouri. He's listening to us there in St. Louis, Missouri. John, good afternoon. You're on the air with John Lott.
Hello, guys. I actually live in a little town called Farmington, but I'm up in St. Louis right now.
Great to have you.
And the problem with Missouri is we have a state Supreme Court that created some law allowing criminals who steal to just get out after 48 hours. They don't have to post bond or anything. It's usually the druggies, the drug addicted people. Mm-hmm. There'll be a drug dealer who's also owns a pawn shop, and they'll steal and then bring the junk to him.
Yeah.
But this stealing, you know, they say, well, you know, when they steal stuff from your home, your personal property, it's no big deal, but they won't do anything unless they kill somebody or commit some type of violent act. And really, when they steal your stuff out of your house, it's such a terrible violation, and it can ruin people's lives.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you, John. Let me let Mr. Lott respond to you on that. A couple things. I think drugs are a big driver in a lot of this type of crime, especially with theft. But I'll let you address what he had to say there, because he goes back to what we were saying. You know, you could steal up to almost $1,000, and it's a slap on the wrist if you get caught or even stopped. Some of these prosecutors aren't even, you know, prosecuting these types of crime. People know they can get away with it. I've seen video of people leaving stores with bags full of filet mignon, and you know, they could walk out, or stealing stuff from pharmacies. Now we're beginning to see more things locked up, but your thoughts, Mr. Lott.
Right. Well, I think this is much broader than just people who are drug addicts or on illegal drugs. You know, it's very profitable. People go and take things out of stores and then resell the items on eBay.
Yep.
And, you know, if you're talking about, you know, 1% of all property crimes result in an arrest, and even a smaller percentage of that result in a conviction, you know, it's a pretty high profit business that you can have there, where you can go and steal things and then resell them. It's not like you have a big cost that are there. They're not having to pay for the items up front. And, you know, you have in many major cities, Walmarts have closed down, CVS's, Walgreens, you know, whether you're talking about Chicago or places like San Francisco, because they just can't operate when you're having such massive theft that's occurring. As you say, in California, you can steal up to $950.
It's crazy.
And, you know, if they do give you any type of punishment, it'll essentially be a ticket, which is just the cost of doing a business. That's there.
Yeah. Well, John, I have to hold it right there because I'm up against the clock. My apologies to everyone on hold. Check out crimeresearch.org if you want to see all the latest data. And check out Mr. Lott's article, Americans Being Misled, Crime More Rampant Than Being Reported. It ran in the Wall Street Journal, I think, the other day. Forget when I came across it, but it's well worth a read. It's eye-opening. If you feel crime is rising in your area and you're wondering why, and yet the stats say something different, this dives into it and tells you the true story. John, thank you for your time. We'll catch up again soon, okay?
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
God bless you. Chapel of Divine Mercy is straight ahead. I hope you'll join me on the other side. I'm going to be joined after the chapel by a friend. And we've been praying for her son. And I really believe, personally, something miraculous took place. Even surgeons and neurologists are scratching their head. They don't seem to have an explanation. You know, those are my favorite type of responses to the way God works. Stay with me. We'll pray when I return.